It was summer, 90 degrees, New York City, midnight, and I'm laying there stark naked trying to sleep, and there's not an ounce of wind blowing, just the heavy New York City summer air. And I had a suite, a very large space, and the windows were very cool. One set of windows faces the Rose Garden and the Hudson River, and the other faces the front of the yard where the fish pond is. So I'm just laying there, and all the windows are open, and all of a sudden there's a hand on my back. And I think, oh, son of a gun. That is not a human hand. I really wish it was a human hand, but it's not a human hand. And so I just lay there strategizing how I'm going to catch him, because I got one chance of catching him. Because a black chimp in the black of night in the Bronx is going to be really hard to catch, right? So, and, you know, I could tell he was really spooked, because he was doing his little hooting. And so I just said, all right, Joyce, you got one chance of this, and so you better do it, and you better do it right. And I moved and grabbed him and had him. Thank God, right? Because otherwise, how do you catch a chimpanzee in the Bronx? I don't know, in the middle of the night, you know.
I'm Ariel Zumross, and this is a show about animals. Project Coco. Last time, Columbia University researcher Herb Terrace embarks on this ambitious experiment to try to teach a chimpanzee sign language.
I was single at the time. I could not raise a chimpanzee by myself.
He asks his former student, Stephanie Lafarge, to take Nim Chimpsky in.
I had seven children, a brownstone in New York, a cooperative husband. I tried to reproduce everything that a chimpanzee mother would do.
But Herb and his team soon realized that the Upper West Side of New York City may not be the best place to raise a chimpanzee.
The family he lived with were not fluent signers. I did see him being given marijuana.
You did?
And did not approve.
And so, after almost 2 years, Herb starts looking for a new place for Nim to live.
I happened to be friendly with the president of the university, and I knew of this estate up in Riverdale. This estate used to be used by the president of the university as a summer home. So I asked if I got funds to pay for the heat, could I use the estate? Surprisingly, the answer was yes.
The chimp, Nim, moves out of the Upper West Side brownstone into this huge mansion just north of Manhattan called Delafield.
We lived in a mansion on the Henry Hudson in the Palisades on 17 acres of land.
Today, Dr. Laura Ann Petito is a neuroscientist and professor of psychology at Gallaudet University, which is the only college in the world that caters specifically to students who use American Sign Language and English. But back then, she's in her early 20s, and she's in charge of managing the day-to-day of the Nim Project.
I should only have been raised like Nim Chimpsky.
You would drive up to the main gate, and there was this huge center part of the house with columns for two stories and a wings on either side of the house.
Herb and Lauren bring on a bevy of student handlers, including 19-year-old college student Joyce Butler, who you heard from at the beginning of this episode.
So Nim had half the house, and the people who cared for him had half the house.
And they're going to live with Nim at Delafield and really be at Nim's beck and call.
He had the kitchen, the laundry room, a bathroom, and a dining room in his first floor. I lived on one wing of the house on the top floor, above the cherry library and the ballroom that had steps that went down into the ballroom with lights on the steps.
Sounds like it was kind of a fancy environment for a chimp.
I think it was a fancy environment for the people.
At any given time, there are about 24 or more people involved in the project. Laura Ann oversaw them as project coordinator.
They were the people who analyzed the data. They were the people who bought his diapers. They were the people who got me groceries when I couldn't leave the house. And I also taught them sign language.
Laura Ann is one of the few people on the NIM project who grew up using American Sign Language. She says some of her relatives were deaf. So she was well-versed in it. But NIM's other caretakers signed with him too, both at Columbia and at Delafield.
We would often be on the back lawn of the house overlooking the Hudson River underneath the huge elm and oak and beech trees. And we would sit there and...
This is Joyce Butler again, who lived with NIM at Delafield. Joyce says that on nice days, they would spend time outside, going through the signs they wanted NIM to learn.
NIM would be happy to sit. I would draw a picture of a face in my kindergarten-style skills, and I would point to pictures, you know, this is an eye, where's your eye? And he would point to his eye and, you know, silly things like that.
Those kinds of interactions might seem like fun anecdotes, but this is the data, right? This is what's being recorded for later analysis.
We were hopeful that in the communicative interaction, there would be language that would be revealed to us through the videotape analyses.
So NIM is learning more and more signs.
Play, tickle, chase, gum.
And he appears to start to string them together.
His sequence could be chase, tickle there, and then off he'd go. Because I just got the command that I needed to run after him and tickle him on whatever body part he just identified.
Oh my God, this is so amazing. He's signing, he's learning signs. We were going to do it.
There was a constantly changing cast of teachers.
Robert Sapolsky, who you may remember spent a day in Central Park with NIM. He volunteered right before NIM was moved to Delafield.
My being a great example of it. Like, I showed up, I spent 3 months like wanting to be the most important primate in NIM's life and all of that. And then that was over with and picked up and went back to college. And that was just a constant stream for NIM like that. It was emotionally unstable for NIM.
He didn't have an unstable upbringing. He didn't have random people thrown at him. These were people whose whole lives were dedicated to him.
So there's some disagreement there. The issue is this. If you have too many handlers, all with different levels of sign language ability, how can the scientists on this project assess if NIM has a consistent command of language?
You know, you really do need like a native language speaker to teach somebody a language. None of us knew what we were doing. None of us were particularly conversant.
I did not use ASL at all. I would say I used Pidgin English. The rest of us were, you know, just learning as we went and picking up the important signs.
To be fair, Laura Ann and a few others did know ASL, but the situation still raises a critical question.
How do we prove whether or not the chimp had language based on grammatical structure when the integrity of the ASL or Pidgin English was inconsistent?
Remember, Herb Terrace says he set out to create this rigorous environment where the chimp could learn language. But in practice, it doesn't seem like he followed his own playbook very strongly.
With Laura and I did have a brief relationship. So what?
At one point, he was in a relationship with one of the staffers on the project who was helping him run it, Laura Ann Petito.
I mean, she was your research assistant, right?
Yeah.
You were like twice her age?
Not quite.
But you were around, you were in your late 30s and she was early 20s.
Right, yeah. It was totally consensual. I don't believe anybody knew about it on the project. And I don't think it had any effect on the project.
The significance of that relationship was short-lived, and it had no interference with my science. Look, at my age then, I thought I was a woman of the world. However, Many of my students think they're men of the world, but it's my job to know and live honorably, and it's my job to act appropriately. But we all learn our lessons, and it was a life lesson.
So the project carries on at Delafield. But then, in 1977, the NIM project comes to an end. The reason, according to Herb, isn't due to any sort of lack of structure or any secret romance, for that matter. At this point, he thinks the sign language project is working for NIM. The chimp is learning, right? The problem for the project is that NIM is growing up and becoming stronger and acting like a chimp.
You see a very adorable chimp in the photographs in their Oshkosh B'gosh overalls and jumping through the fields of Delafield. But one must remember is that these are wild animals.
Wild animals can be unpredictable to humans. For example, NIM bit sometimes, which is normal. Biting is just something chimps do. They nip at each other for play and for defense. But as he got older...
He was getting to be too dangerous. Teachers who we got along with very well, I would hear reports that he would suddenly bite them savagely.
Which Herb could have expected.
You don't go into the jungle and pluck out a lion cub and take it into 246th Street in the Bronx, and suddenly you've made a human.
Chimps are hella strong, like way stronger than people. They're capable of breaking skin, and then some.
That chimpanzee was a wild chimpanzee. He never ceased to be a wild and dangerous chimpanzee.
But look, there were some precautions you could take to keep interactions between humans and chimps safe for everyone. But it seems like the setup with NIM, unfortunately, is not ideal. And as NIM gets older and continues to work up close with people who are touching him and asking him to do things, the humans around NIM are getting hurt.
I learned his vocalizations. I learned his physical and behavioral cues that taught me when he was about to go into attack and attack to kill. I learned his language of communication so that I could survive life with him.
But even that wasn't always enough. Laura Ann says that at one point, NIM did bite her hard. And a few other people we spoke to remembered NIM biting people hard enough that they had to go to the hospital and get stitches.
I didn't consider stopping the experiment until it became dangerous for the teachers.
What are the circumstances around NIM's departure from Delafield? What do you remember?
They're very horrible, and I will not be able to do this without crying. So the project ended when Herb brought us all together and told us it was over. And I didn't even see that coming. I was like, what? What? Like, can't we problem solve? Can't we figure this out? No, it's done. Over.
So Herb decides to take NIM and send him back to where he came from, to the Institute for Primate Studies in Oklahoma.
And that was the end. At that point, I was 19 years old, and I was enormously naive, and I expected this was a lifetime commitment, because as with children, you don't send them back when the going gets tough. So I never assumed for a heartbeat that I wouldn't be there for the long haul, and NIM wouldn't be there for the long haul. So we have a car. How far is Canada? Can we run?
Did you really consider that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But it's kind of hard to run with a chimp, you know, kind of, you're kind of obvious. I proceeded to lose 20 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And had to just kind of bury that because it was so wrong.
But the end of Project NIM wasn't the only bomb that Herb was going to drop on his volunteers and employees. That's after the break. With Nim Chimpsky gone, Herb Terrace is ready to go through all the years of data he's been collecting, all the tapes, all the spreadsheets, every word, laugh, and tickle fight. Herb says he thinks he's found it.
Evidence that Nim could produce sentences.
Oh, Hugh, I wish you could have interviewed me then. I was...
I wish I could have interviewed you then, too.
I was going to reach across the evolutionary abyss.
I was in seventh heaven. I thought I had done what I wanted to do.
But as Herb is looking back at these videos of Nim, he notices something for the first time.
There, staring in my face, was evidence that it was an artifact.
An artifact. This is basically science speak for, oh shit, we fucked up, we misinterpreted the data.
I sort of stepped back a little, you know, unwittingly, and I saw that whenever Nim signed, just a quarter of a second or so beforehand, the teacher signed what he was supposed to sign. And that observation, within a quarter of a second, I decided the whole thing was no good. She's saying who, and he's going cat. Who again? Him, he says me.
What Terrace comes to believe is that Nim is basically going through the motions. He's done this enough times with his teachers that he knows what to do.
So Nim is scratching his head for Nim. She's signing hug. He signs hug.
No one, including Herb, noticed this dynamic as it was happening. They had to go to the videotape to see it.
I was guilty of what's called the clever Hans effect.
Which is basically this well-known cautionary tale in science.
Can you explain the clever Hans effect?
Hans was an actual horse in Germany. And his teacher claimed that he could perform arithmetic operations and spell.
The story goes that this guy named Willem von Austin takes his horse, Hans, on a traveling roadshow around Berlin. Now, the idea here is that his horse is some kind of math genius. Von Austin would write a math problem on the board to demonstrate this.
The teacher would write 3 + 2 on the board, and Hans would tap his leg 5 times.
And then the horse, Hans, would solve the problem by tapping out the answer with his hoof.
Even when outside observers came in and gave Hans a problem, he came up with the right answer. It took the cream of German scientists a year to figure out what was going on.
It turns out that every time Hans answered the math problem correctly, it was because the horse was responding to something his trainer was doing. Something, so the story goes, that the trainer didn't even know he was doing.
What happened is whenever the teacher, say, put 2 + 1 on the board, the teacher would inhale unconsciously in anticipation, is he going to get it right or not? And then Hans had learned, you know, tapping is a good thing, just like Nim learned that signing is a good thing. And when the horse tapped the right number of times, the teacher would exhale. And behold, you get the right answer. The horse certainly didn't know arithmetic, just like Nim didn't know sign language, but it seemed as if he behaved that way.
The thesis that Herb Terrace set out to find evidence for, that animals can speak in a human language, wasn't borne out. He got what scientists call a negative result. Basically, Nim grew to understand what the teachers wanted him to respond when they asked him a question. He knew he would get positive reinforcement for responding in this way, which Herb concludes means that he wasn't engaging his teachers in conversations like a human would.
What went through my mind then was a very interesting tension. Part of me said for a second, do I have to tell anybody? I can just go ahead and publish this, and maybe nobody will ever find out.
So Herb had already written the paper saying that Nim signed sentences, like all good here. But in the end, the paper he submitted to Science, one of the most prestigious scientific journals in the world, had a different conclusion. And it was a Molotov cocktail of a scientific paper.
The main goal of Project Nim was to ask whether a chimpanzee could create a sentence. I have concluded that, unfortunately, the answer to that question is no.
I looked at the other videotapes. I saw the same thing. Everywhere I looked, I saw that what I thought was spontaneous was prompted.
But Herb doesn't stop there. He decides that in this paper, he's going to name check a bunch of other researchers and other studies in the ape language field. And he's going to tell them that they, too, have fallen prey to the Clever Hans effect.
I published tracings of a 16-millimeter film of Beatrice Gardner and Washoe showing the same things.
He looks through public videos of other studies, like Washoe and Coco.
You could see, without any knowledge of sign language, how almost every sign that Coco made was prompted by Penny.
Herb also argues publicly that Penny Patterson is interpreting Coco's interactions in a way that simply confirms what she wants to believe. Penny responds to this accusation with the scientific version of, show me the receipts.
I asked Herbert Terras to send his videos, and I looked at them, and I could see, I hate to say this, it looked like Nim knew more than the caregivers. Or it may be that the project was started by a professor who wanted to prove that it wasn't true.
To this day, Penny takes issue with Herb's assessment of her work. And Herb takes issue with Penny's accusation that he started off the NIM study with the intention to discredit ape language researchers. Needless to say, they are not friends.
I mean, why would I start a project and then pull the plug and say this isn't any good? I mean, the amount of work I did in organizing Nim's life, in finding teachers, in analyzing his data, in filming his performance, was full time, 7 days a week. To suddenly say it's no good, it's crazy. Why would I do that?
Herb also insists that despite all of the flaws involved in his experiment, the results of the NIM project are clear.
Because you could always point to ideal circumstances where there were fewer teachers and everybody was more fluent. I readily acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. I don't think the results would have been any different. We all project onto animals all kinds of human attitudes. That's why Dr. Doolittle is so famous. That's why there are all these stories about talking to animals. But it's all projection.
All of it?
All of it.
Everything.
As far as I'm concerned, yes.
After the NIM project ends, Herb leaves ape language research in his rearview mirror. He just switches his focus. Whereas Penny Patterson devotes 4 decades of her life to one gorilla.
I was impressed that one, you can have a gorilla docile enough to interact with Penny, but I didn't think the experiments, if you want to call it that, I mean, she was mainly interacting with Coco.
What does that indicate to you?
A lack of rigor. That it was more a hobby than scientific research.
So I had to ask Penny about that too, and she said that actually her work was rigorous, and she pointed out that she was awarded a PhD and was published in leading scientific journals because of it. Despite the response to the response to the response, this argument between Penny and Herb ends up being crucial and presents a huge obstacle for the endeavor to answer whether humans are the only beings with language.
He showed predispositions or preferences in order. But the moment he went beyond that, it was just a repeat of only the top 10 signs. Banana, orange, apple, eats, more, nim. It's not uninteresting that he learned 10 signs and would produce them over and over again. It's just that it's different. And it's fascinating. It teaches you something about you, about me, about our mind, and what our mind is giving, the gift we got, for whatever reason in evolution, the gift that our species got.
But others see the legacy of the NIM project differently.
When I read it as it's published, well, I feel like throwing the book through the window. You know, it makes me very angry that a life was used and that the outcome is not, in my mind, accurate. Did he have language? I will say absolutely. He was able to communicate many of his needs. Did we sit down and talk about Plato? No, we did not. But would you with a 2, 3, or 4-year-old? No. And you think about a child who has that kind of trauma of different people in and out of his life. What happens to those kids? Does their language get impacted before they're four? I'm betting it does.
And then for Joyce Butler, the project was structured in a way that was unfair to NIM.
For me, the story is the chimp had language. Ultimately, the commitment to him should have been there for the long haul.
More than four decades later, people we talk to still have a lot of feelings about what happened here. And about the way Herb's research basically set off a series of events that changed ape language research forever.
The New York Times had that front page thing on sign language project questions the entire field coming out this week in Science. And like, I had sort of lost touch with everybody from the project by then, but damn, this is gonna take down the whole field. And indeed it did.
That's next week. A show about animals is a production of Vice News. It's hosted and reported by me, Ariel Zumross. Our producers are Julia Nutter and Pete Lang Stanton. Our production assistant is Leili Rezvani. Sound design and original score by Pran Bandy, with additional support by Steve Bone. Annie Aviles is our executive editor. Kate Osborne is our executive producer and the VP of Vice Audio. Special thanks to Maximo Anderson for fact-checking. A Show About Animals returns next week. If you like what you hear, please take the time to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find the show. And if you can't do that, hit subscribe. That helps too.